so I'm delighted to be here, and your building is very impressive. I'm talking about work. Okay, we're done with all the roles of Dr. Kingston, my student Gary, that's Stanford, and Y.U. Taylor, that's my team. That should appear in the next few weeks, we can finish writing. And what I'm saying is also based on work we did earlier with these people, and more generally motivated by what's on the front of other people getting closer to speed. So, I'll start with a sort of general introduction, not to string theory, but to the classical one of the study. And I think it's fair to say that the study of string theory over the past 80 years has now reached the point, or frankly, it reached the point a decade ago, where for models of supersymmetry, you can lose the fine scale, we know an awful lot, and there's a good facts about what we know, and there's an absurd facts about what we know. There are a vast array of constructions. This is clear not just by thinking, but by counting the number of papers you can study different constructions. And these have both supersymmetry theory model and also a large number of constructions that have supersymmetry that can move a fine scale, but break it at some lower scale. Okay, so in four-dimensional way, they have supersymmetric constructions, it's not the case of supersymmetry. And the known ingredients in the theory, which in type two strings, which I'll focus on, include various fluxes, p-form change fields, brains, and various non-interpretive effects. That suffice by any genericity argument or reasonable counting from global energy field models that are rigid, models that do not fly at all, okay, models where the quantity of geometry is frozen into a physical shape. So a typical picture in those constructions would be, here's the Flaviat case, it's really orientable, and if you want to get any influence of the symmetry, but I'll be good without that. And there's some D-brains, constructions all discuss between 3 and 7 brains, with type 2B, and then the Flaviat is not a cycle, it would be lost. And some more things would be true, we've had a lot of extremes, I won't talk about it, the story there is slightly more complicated, and hasn't been worked out in as much detail. So, as I said, our knowledge of these things puts us in a kind of awkward situation where there's some good things, some bad things. The good thing is that, as was clear already in the 80s, but now it's ever clearer in many more ways, you can find models that look awfully well, like the standard model of particle physics, and you're getting to the point where, given some beyond the standard model scenario, you can pretty much cook it up in string theory. It's kind of hard to find things that those guys talk about that we can't do. Okay. So it's a natural place for exploring options for beyond the standard model of physics, and it's inspired a lot of work in beyond the standard model of physics. And more people are also trying to make contact with perfect inverse cosmology as we get convinced that the cosmologists are talking about, and in particular, inflation and insulation structure has been a subject of a lot of work. That's some of the question here. But this also leads us into a very difficult situation if we are what I call top-down string theorists, where we think our goal is to make a predictive, and in some sense, though what sense is not quite clear, unique theory of nature. Because, well, there's just practical issues and they're conceptual issues. Practically, given the level of possibilities, regardless of whether you want to find the right vacuum to describe the world, or if theory is right, it's not even clear how to usually describe it. You need a language, you need some kind of summary of the data that goes into describing a vacuum. You need some kind of description analogous to the description of Flaviat modulized cases. It's worked out. By what criteria are vacuum chosen? If there are a lot of possibilities, which ones are preferred by cosmology or by some other criteria you might have? What is the measure? If you get into this issue very deeply, you'll have to come to grips with the terminal inflation. I'm not going to talk about that, but in the end, one will need to know from some kind of top-down theory what a terminal inflation even means. And the underlying, of course, desperation of all string theorists is can we predict anything in this framework? Can we find things that can be spectacularly confirmed that aren't necessarily true but happen to be true in our world? Okay, so those are very general issues and kind of vague, and this talk I won't really touch on anything except the first. Okay, I'll describe modest progress on the first issue I raised, which is how do you usefully describe the structure of the space vacuum? And I'll just do this one quarter of string theory, type 2B, one class, very large class of compact cases, but similar descriptions should exist for other very large classes. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. So I'm going to talk about a class of 2D.2 that I exported this paper, it's called Fitzgibbon's homework, many others. Okay. And these vacuum arise from F-theory compact applications on collapsed orbitals, or in more friendly language, there's some limited of these F-theory compact applications where you get type 2D on a Calabi-L space, Calabi-L-free pole. That would normally preserve n equals 2 supersymmetry, but if you orient the pole you can get an angle 1. And I'm going to assume, as is true for the models that arise in this way, that the oriental action has only fixed points and fixed surfaces, or that is, you only introduce both 3 of those 7 planes, but you know, or 5 or 9 planes. Under those assumptions, you can show that the solutions of the 2D theory have the following structure, which I'll summarize quickly. The 10 metric takes the form of the warp product in the leading approximation of every expansion of Minkowski space with an internal metric that is plotted out. Now, the Calabi-L metric also has this warp factor, so it's not really a Calabi-L space, it's conformally Calabi-L space. The 2D theory also has various gauge fields, whose expectation values I have to tell you about in particular, since it has 1 range and 3 range, it has 3-fold field strength and a 5-fold field strength. The 5-fold field strength is self-dual, and takes the general form 1 plus the high star times dx in all the space-time coordinates and my backspace time coordinates. And in general, the alpha, where alpha is some function on the compact angle. This is the most general ensemble consistent with horizon units. And d alpha is always a trivial one form because Calabi L space does not have homologically non-trivial. Now the 3-4 field strengths are slightly more interesting. And Calabi L does in general have interesting free forms. Okay, so if you combine the 2 free forms, one that couples to strings H and one that couples to D strings F, into a complex free form, the fact that the delta on there because NS fields enter differently in the action of the moon or fields, you see that first of all in general they can be non-trivial. You can give non-trivial free form expectation values on the plot down. And in fact you can show that to get a solution to the equations of motion, G3, this complex combination, has to satisfy the following equation. If high star on the internal space should be high times itself. This is analogous to an equation for instantons in for 2-form field strength, which is an imaginary self-duality condition instead of a self-duality condition. And this kind of equation has arisen from people. And this equation, together with the previous one, and standard equations of motion from the warp factor of the dilaton, also yield the conclusion that form alpha is related to the warp factor, and you can determine these things, but they won't be important for us. What will be important for us throughout is this equation. Fluxes are quantized in string theory. They're not continuous. They're quantized by an analog of direct quantization. And so if I choose a basis of the 3 cycles in our extra dimensions, sigma I, or in simple examples, there can be a few hundred topological constraints. All right, it's a big string. Then I get to choose a set of integers consistent with the quantization condition that tell me exactly how the flux is spreading the extra dimensions. So for each such recycle, I get to choose a flux of G. That's the mode of molecule, then the H, and S. So the correct way to think about this class of models is the following. You choose a Calabi L space, and you choose an oriented form action, and you're not quite done specifying the model. Then you get to choose any fluxes that you want, subject to the centrality constraint, and one more. And only after you've chosen fluxes do you get 1 4-dimensional vector field theory. Fluxes are quantized, so different choices in that give rise to different 4-dimensional vector field theories. It's actually not proved in general that it's not. It's suspected by us on various grounds. I can talk a bit more about that, but it's suspected. At the very worst, subject to some simple physical constraint. That's all belonging to the other part. Do you have something more detailed in mind?
Well, when you can quantify the size of the matrix, it's you can't classify state for the most effective people to look at the creation.
Well, the thing is, as I said here, I'll talk about before, but I'm working in a framework where I use caveat three bullets. Okay? And the number of caveat three bullets that are currently known is fine. There are suspicions of people who are more acquainted with those techniques, which are from me, like Yao, that the actual number is going to be fine. Right? There is no proof of this. So that's the situation. There are other spaces beyond caveats that also need to control solutions in string theory. But again, they all satisfy some equation, which imposes that they have what's called an S3 structure. And again, there's suspicion that the number of subspaces is fine. But, okay. So, now, like I said, you have to specify the space, but in addition, you have to specify these integer fluxes. And you can't specify any old integer fluxes you want, or you would, well, you end up with infinite number of models already at this level, and you have a much harder problem. And the reason you can't is that there's a Gauss's law. The Gauss's law says that on compact space, the sum of any electric charges has to add up to zero. You can't put electrons on a sphere without any number of positive. And in this theory, that tells you, if you integrate the Yonke identity for the five, that the number of space-filling free rings from these constructions must exactly cancel against an anomalous contribution from the fluxes to the free range charge of the extreme regions. And also, a contribution coming from any orientable planes that arise in the construction is called L. And in F theory language, you can think of this L as being induced from the curvature term on seventh grade trapping on trees. Now, a simple proof actually shows you might think that we're still in trouble if the number is obviously infinite at this level because this has no definite sign, right? H by F in general will be n if you want. But a simple proof shows that on solutions of the equation of motion, when the star g is ig, this is actually possible, something like that. So you have two contributions, which there's enough examples to both be positive, and it's plausible, and in fact true in simple cases, that the number of possible choices is finite. Now, given what I just told you, that on solutions of the equations h by f is positive, you can probably look at the equation I just described at that tabular condition as being an allowed region in flux space in cohomology labs that's given by taking some quadratic form and mapping the h vectors, their h3 initial vectors, and saying that this quadratic form is less than everything else. It's positive. And in the limit that L is a large number compared to the dimension of the vector space compared to V3, the number of points in such a region depends on the many physicists who have estimations of physical mechanics, right? You just say, well, there will be like one last point for unit volume, so you distribute the volume of this region in the space. And that scales like L to V3. It's a sphere of radius from L in 2D3 dimensions. Now, in easy examples, this sample of yield numbers that are something like 10 to the 300, as this was first realized by Russell and Wolchinski in an interrelated test. That doesn't alone show that there's any kind of large number vacuum, because that just can tell me you can choose fluxes consistent with Gauss's law. It doesn't mean you can solve the equation for motion. But in fact, typical flux choices can lead to vacua for reasons I'll describe. And so in some degree of approximation, simple examples here is in vacuum. This is also why I'm not talking about how many Claudial spaces there are. The known number today for three folds is the order of 10 to the 4th and 10 to the 5th, and is actually dwarfed by the number of vacuum you get from this construction on any one Claudial space. Yeah?
When you say these are vacua, are these known to be vacuum to the level of the constants of gravity?
That's what I'll describe very briefly in on this follow review. And they're also suspected in many cases to be vacuum of the quantum. And we don't have an exact definition of string theory, but we actually have a good knowledge of what directions exist to the low energy type of field theory.
But you don't have consistent Wolch.
Oh, no. Well, there are remote and fluxes. So no one knows the Wolch description any more than they can create against five fluxes. And furthermore, as we'll discuss later on, even G-string gets fixed from these constructions. So a perturbative Wolch description may well be outreached. Now, when that's the kind of number you're working with, at least to me, it says that any credible understanding of the set of vacua will require statistical proof. Okay, you're just not going to describe each one and know something thinking about its physics. You need to understand. And this is not a question of our claim, it's just obvious that you have large numbers. We'll talk about that shortly, what I mean by that. But first, let's describe the four-dimensional effective field theories that arise. I think that both places will have that resources for that. Okay, so as I said, each choice of Bobbiel or Enfield action of losses will lead up to dualities, two distinct four-dimensional effective Lagrangian. The dualities I have in mind here are the line of the actual wave choices. The theory was chosen to have able ones for symmetries includes the Klein scale. That's something I do for convenience. There are problems string theories developed. So at the scale 1 over R, I can integrate out all the stringy junk. I'll be left with a four-dimensional effective field theory, and it's supersymmetric. Which means it can be described by supersymmetric effective field theory. And up to two derivatives, that means I should tell you a K1 potential and a superpotential. And if I wanted to talk about gauge fields, I should tell you a gauge coupling function, but I don't need that. Now, the white nodes in this theory, the chiral fields that have masses much less than 1 over R, are the moduli of the Bobbiel, the way you push around its shape and size, which consists of, in general, a moduli of its complex structure. The axial dilaton, which means G string, is all around. And then Taylor moduli, which controls the size of the space. And for my purposes, I'll just say there's one, but there could be many different masses. Nothing that I say can depend on. Now, the leading orders, following old work of Witten, you can derive the Kalor potential that arises by dimensional reduction directly, and takes this form as a log of the axial dilaton, a log of the volume modulus, which is a factor of 3 that will play a role in a second. And this omega log omega bar, which governs the measure of the complex structure moduli space. And it's useful to notice that, so omega is the holomorphic 3 form that exists on any Bobbiel. You can define the periods of this holomorphic form by integrating it over a basis of 3 cycles. I'm using some symmetric basis here, and you can satisfy some of the product. And given that period factor, you can rewrite this rather explicitly as just being the log of pi data of sigma pi, pi is the vector and sigma is the symmetric basis. And really, since I'm doing orientable, I should project the invariant moduli of the orientable that actually again. I'll just take that. Now, given this period vector, in terms of which you know the KR potential, you can also write a simple formula for the superpotential. It was derived by Gudenhoff and Witten. And you just take your G3 plus, you write it with the whole free form, and that gives you something in the form f dot pi minus the whole condensation. And that's supposed to be exact to all orders in perturbation theory. That's famous fact due to the Ferrara-Benedict equation. That the n equals 1 supergravity then takes this form, determined by the superpotential, the measure of a moduli space. And in supergravity, there's this famous minus VW squared term, which would not be present in the global limit, it's down by the power of step 1. The derivatives that appear there are KR covariant types. And in this class of models, as in actually many classes of spring models, for the physical reason, something special happens to this. There is this famous negative term. But in these models, what happens is the superpotential isn't a generic function, at least to this order, in fact, all orders in perturbation theory, because it doesn't depend on the Taylor model. It depends only on the complex structure, particularly in terms of G like omega. So if you evaluate the Taylor covariant derivative of W, you only get a contribution from this covariantization term when you have the Taylor moduli, and that gives you this formula for the case of one modulus. And if you then plug that in, you'll see that in fact the row term here, the one that comes on the Taylor moduli, is exactly the W squared, independent of anything else. And so it cancels the negative. And so the potential, actually, becomes positive semi-definite, and just involves a sum over the delta on the complex structure moduli, even though we're in super. This cancellation is a famous cancellation that was first observed in the early 80s by, I think, Ellison and Ophelos and others. It's called the no-scale cancellation. These models are called no-scale supergravity models. And they were a source of great excitement because in this class of models, the potential was positive semi-definite and vacuum all static vanishing potential. And this works well for people who worry about velocities. But anyway, that doesn't supply corrections. So that's where people are excited.
This question, what do you mean by orders of perturbation theory if you don't know the scheme of perturbation theory and the fraction?
Yeah, so you know the perturbation theory in alpha prime quite well. And you know certain things about holomorphic quantities called orders of perturbation. So you can prove non-renormalization theorems that show that W is not fractions determinately. Furthermore, you have formulas for non-recursive fractions to double units, it's called more special. So while I couldn't give you the 9 loop effective action for all fields, I could give you, in some cases, exact formulas for W. And given an exact formula for W and some approximate formula for Taylor potential, you can then do standard self-consistency checks that this is called to. So this, you should think of this as similar to when Fiber had exact results for supersymmetric field theories in the 90s. This is not exact results where you know the Taylor potential exactly is all orders from G. You don't. But what you know is the super potential, and using that information is easy, very effective.
So is it sufficient to talk about perturbation theory, just standard finite perturbation theory and the supergravity theory, even if it's not normalized in order by order, there's
absolutely.
And how does the argument go in this case? Because, you know, the standard argument in the old days was that the Dilipan interference that you...
So right, for the Kaler moduli, it's just a standard axiom. For the Dilipan, I think you actually have to appeal to an argument involving supergraphs or SLP features. As the Dilipan appears, they're actually normal. But I think that there's still an non-normalization here that you can argue for the way Rochek et al. Originally argued for non-normalization.
So it's a graph by graph.
It would be a graph by graph argument. Right, the original argument is not based on formal gain, it's actually based on structure of theta integrals in superspace.
But you really started believing it when you had the symmetry argument, right?
I think it's, you know, there are arguments both ways. I like the symmetry argument better. Okay. This no scale cancellation, at meeting orders in every expansion, persists for models with general H1 mode M, so I showed it here with the one Kaler module, so the 3 that in that. And in this approximation, all that will have V equals 0. Because if V is positive, the key of the K factor will cause a parabola over the ring. So all of that will have V equals 0. And so they have to satisfy, since this is positive, DAW equals D by W equals 0. On the other hand, D rho W in general isn't 0, it's proportional to W itself. And so generally, supersymmetry is broken by the vanishing curve in this approximation. Now, supersymmetric factors, about which you might be able to say more, will be those where W is also 0 from for some miraculous reason. Okay, I say for some miraculous reason because, in this approximation, W is a function of the phi's and the CAs, the complex structure moduli, the Dilipan, not the Kaler moduli. And so if we impose W equals CW equals 0, we're imposing H21 plus 2 equations on H21 plus 1 variables. And everyone knows you cannot usually solve such a system like that with 0. If you're trying to solve for all those variables 0. So in this approximation, generic fluxes lead to supersymmetry breaking. But the world includes a Klein scale at a scale that in fact will permit if you want to go cubed instead of overall. So you still have a supersymmetric effect of field theory. And at this level, phi and CA typically have isolated factors. So already, with the simplest constructions, you fix the Dilipan. And this would bring us back to Lee's question, do you have a permanent string assertion? Of course, no, Dilipan fits. But you can fix it at any coupling in sort of fractional construction. The fraction is small, but the number is large. Okay. Now, this approximation is obviously awful in many ways. The first way that it's clear that it's awful is that you have supersymmetric vacuum with vanishing vacuum energy, and you know that there's no symmetry that's going to, non-supersymmetric vacuum with vanishing vacuum energy. There's no symmetry that will protect that. So you better start thinking about corrections. In many models, but not all, there are non-perturbative corrections that we know actually have computed, either from cyber nest arguments in effective field theory, or from witness description of them in terms of Euclidean rings. And these can lead to a non-perturbative superpotential that depends on Kaler moduli. In every model that anyone ever writes down, the Kaler potential gets corrected. The first correction has actually been computed explicitly by the Becker's, Hawk, and Lewis and supergravity techniques. So if you have construction that you think solves the equations of motion, you can do the standard self-consistency test for physicists. You improve the corrections you know, and you check whether the first correction, the Kaler potential, changes what you know by order 1. If it doesn't, if it's down by some power of the parametric thing like 1 over r, then you can ignore the corrections. Given these corrections, generically, you can now solve d rho w equals 0 because the super potential and Kaler potential are generic enough that the equations here will have to be one more equation, but one more field also. Okay. Sorry, one more equation would be u mod w equals 0 instead of w equals 0. And so you should expect to be able to find supersymmetric factor but they won't have zero cost one. They'll be an infinite series. And further argument along these lines suggests that there's no problem by consider factoring in this class either, and there's now huge literature on that subject. It's very interesting, but I'm not going to talk about it. But I'm going to talk about something else. And that's that a deeper understanding of the structure of just the first set of approximations I described, they don't say I'm not doing, seems to be required and it seems necessary for several reasons. One is, to get control in the full picture, you need to have accomplished this first step in the scale stabilization complex structure delta online with small g string in the small supersymmetry range. That will give you the small expansion parameters you need to justify your analysis. Okay? And so you want to know how often that happens. And that's why people really started undertaking this endeavor of I would say, statistical study using the scale back here. And it shows that you can indeed achieve small g string and small value, not generically, but in a small fraction and large absolute examples. But also, and maybe more interestingly, this could be a good one model for full results. If you just forget about the other moduli, take the tree level potential, which is surely not exact, it gets g-string directions, it gets alpha prime directions. But the point is, these are already fairly generic functions that come out of some of the ingredients of string theory. And if you just study the resulting distributions of vacua and the properties of vacua that come out of this function, you may actually be getting something that's an approximation to the full results, including all graphs. That's not proven. That's the hypothesis. It was made most forcefully and effectively by string numbers. So I'll just take this attitude. You can take the attitude that you're studying this ensemble in order to get good building blocks for the full theory, which is a very reasonable point of view. Or you can just treat it as a toy model for what I'm for now. Now, that was all review of things that are by now very old. So what am I going to tell you about today? Well, there's several questions about this large set of constructions that you could ask in the vein of my claim to think statistically. First, I'll tell you why you should think statistically. Is how many back folks are there? We already answered that crudely. We're given M and a given choice of oriental action. We're given M A in many such cases. The number back in the scale is like double the D3 of M, where L is this global oriental number, which gives it a degree of order 100. And the answer to that question is what leads us to think we need a statistical theory here. It gets too large to analyze these processes. The next question you could ask is where on the former moduli space do the vacua arise? Okay, there was a moduli space of vacua, a supersymmetric vacua, and a bad approximation. It gets lifted by these corrections in the fluxes. But that means that the vacua will sit at certain points on the old moduli space. So where? And there's a claimed answer to this question, which is remarkably simple. The claim is that not only is the number of vacua over D3, but they're spread over the moduli space with some computable measure. That is, that the density is governed by the tabular monotone. That's not surprising because that just says there's sort of one per unit area on the moduli space. But there's also a curvature. Okay? R is some two-form constructed from the curvature on the moduli space. I could tell it to you in terms of R, I, J, or R, K. Now, to derive this formula, I'm not going to use this formula for anything. Okay? This has been claimed by Toby Douglas. And I found a derivation reasonable. To derive it, they made certain approximations. The most intuitive of which is that in the limit of large L with fixed number of fluxes, you could probably treat your quantized fluxes as continuous, the same way I did in deriving the L of the D3. Now, we'll see that that approximation, while great for some purposes, is actually just not tenable for another question. And so, although it works beautifully for what they did, and in many other cases, you have to delay the stage at which you make this approximation as you want more and more detailed information. And what I'm actually trying to do in this talk is describe to you not only some tests of the claim, but also the kind of theory that we'll need to develop to get some more detailed questions.
Is there a simple argument that shows why the curvature has to be there and not just the parent?
There is no simple argument that does it. I can try to describe to you, if you want at the very end, a complicated argument, which is less complicated than the one they get, but so complicated. The third question you could ask, if you've been able to answer the first two, and as I told you, there are always claims for answers to the first two, is what fraction of the vacuole are supersymmetrical? That is, what fraction of the vacuole have vanishing domain of holothermal fluxes? And this is actually an important question for the following reason. Not because we particularly care about W equals zero no scale vacuole, since we believe no scale is violated, but because if W is zero at tree level, it's actually zero at all orders in three. And that changes some important things. Okay, so let me tell you the sociology of what's being debated by certain people, and then what we're going to do. Many authors right now are debating the quote-unquote generic scale of supersymmetry rating in vacuum of subject to one constraint. The constraint is, of course, that they want small vacuum energy. So the 4D vacuum energy should be much less than 1 to the 4th. Okay. And they're doing this, since, of course, no one can compute this in any given string construction, order by order, perturbation theory. They are making the toy models of an isotope spark. The potential given by the flux formula, ignoring the Gamma model I completely, is exact. And then just trying to see, using that potential literally, what are the characteristics of vacuum that have a plausible. Several authors, including Susskind, Douglas, Raffaele, and Megalopoulos, Yuichi, Roninho, and Silverstein, have argued that small lambda in this system and in a wide variety of systems under a very basic assumption, one that doesn't depend on details, won't favor high scale supersymmetry. Now, that's very counterintuitive to most people who work with supersymmetry, so let me tell you why they say this. The reason is a very simple reason, is that the supergravity potential has the famous size, we know easily. And the positive contributions to the vacuum energy come from sums of F terms and V terms. Now, in any system where you have a distribution of values of W over many vacuola, and the distribution of F and V terms over many vacuola, you can ask, what are the generic situations in which this turns out to be small? It's a fact about this class of vacuola that if you look at generic no-scale solutions, W is uniformly distributed. This is not an obvious fact, it's just it's true about this class study. See. But it would be one of the few distributions, you might guess. Okay, so W is uniformly distributed. That means, to get a cancellation here, you can either have very large W and very large atoms, or very small W and very small atoms. But there are more vacuola at large W because W is uniformly distributed. Okay. So, the most vacuola with lambda close to zero will arise when W is order one and F and V terms are order one, as long as the number of F terms is greater than two. This is just a simple area. That's an argument that sounds plausible. The interesting thing about the argument is it depends on no details of the models except the uniform distribution. And the uniform distribution is the one that 50% of this is to spat out right away. The other 50% would spat out something else, which has been discussed by Dying or Tom Thomas. And they argue that this was really a very misleading thing to do. Okay, they say, suppose W is zero, true well, because of an arcing. R symmetry is guaranteed that W is zero in the solution. Okay. Then, quite plausibly, the only source of W is non-reflective effects. This is actually the way every realistic model of supersymmetry breaking is supposed to work. Supersymmetry is broken dynamically. So, for 20 years, people have studied that model. And non-reflective effects generating a W would lead to a very different distribution than uniform, because if G is uniformly distributed, even one over G squared is not. E to 1 over G squared, and that gives you a distribution that goes like 1 over log. That is the number of vacuola with E to minus 1 over G squared less than or equal to epsilon. Goes like 1 over log. Okay, this makes kind of counterintuitive. All I'm saying is a dimensional transmutation. In a theory that has exponentials, 1/10 of the vacuola would have E to minus 10. And similarly, F terms generated in models of dynamical CC breaking without an inverse log distribution. And these distributions would actually lead to the opposite conclusion. Okay. That small lambda favors low scale symmetry breaking, because in theories of these exponential distributions, it's easiest to get back to the low scales.
Well,
yeah.
Sure.
So,
let's So lambda is negative. So we've got lambda negative.
If you have unbroken system, yes, you all get lambda zero.
If you have lambda system breaking, that can be the size of lambda.
Yeah, so I need that. Right, so the point is, in the vacuum that don't have supersymmetry at the level of pluses, you know the distribution. Most of these flux vacuum are like that. And that was what we led the first authors to make this argument. What Dine is saying is, you're looking under the lamppost when you do that, because a lot of these facts will be supersymmetric, will look like they would have vanishing cosmological constant actually in a leading approximation from no scale, and then it would become negative. But then the leading effects will be exponentially smaller than open. Okay? So all they're doing is saying this could possibly happen, it could change your results. They're not saying they have a concrete model that tells them how often it happens. Now, I remain completely agnostic about this issue. It's an interesting issue. I think it can be debated intelligently. It requires all kinds of assumptions that I don't think are particularly justified, like dimensional on space vacuum being one per vacuum, okay, which is far from obvious because of any cosmological theory. But what I'd like to stress is it raises some concrete questions that one would like to answer if one wants to understand the space vacuum, regardless of whether one of these conclusions coming from something vague. And the relevant question here is, what is the fraction of vacuum of RC? That is, what fraction of string vacuum will have W equals 0 at tree level? Because these facts about non-perturbative effects and their distribution are probably right. And so, to answer this tiny question, or any analogous question, you would like to answer the question, how many vacuum at W equals 0? And that's just a math question. It can be answered in this class very bluntly. So we're going to give simple metrics to the answer. Now, the reason that this is a hard question to answer given what's perfectly known is that the continuous Welch theory of shocking bubbles cannot answer it. Why can't that theory answer it? Well, the reason is simple. It's that the equations are overdetermined. And you have, as I said, for W equals 0, you have one more equation than you have fields on which W depends. That's always true. Now, if Welch were continuous, you conclude that you can always solve these equations. Because you could regard the continuous flux as additional fields, and you could just solve for one of the fluxes in terms of the other fluxes to get rid of the extra equation. So the continuous approximation, if you make it ab initio at the start, instead of actually studying the system, will never lead you to the right answer. This question, and the next, in another way of saying it, actually have more of a number theory, right? They're equations over integers, than an analytic theory, and a theory like one based on continuous functions can't answer such questions. And the last question, which also has similar flavor, is whether the end would be motivated to come on going, whether or not you can care about the base and the assumptions that this is the full answer in the whole theory. And it's just what fraction of that you have enhanced symmetries, in this case, discrete symmetries. Okay. So often the modulized space is the quotient of some type of space by modular group, at least locally. And when that's true, the fixed points of the modular group action lead to enhanced symmetries. So a prototype is the familiar modulized space of complex structures on the torus, given here by a keyhole region. So you know this comes from quotients in the other half played by SL to Z. And there are two special points in this modulized space, tau equals I, and tau equals E, which have enhanced symmetries that are relatively easy to resume. Now, the reason one would care about this is that enhanced symmetries can be of special interest in model building or in cosmology moduli, and people like Dine for years conjectured that for various reasons the real vacua describe our world may be enhanced symmetry points. But counting vacua and given enhanced symmetry points, for roughly the same reasons counting supersymmetric vacua, cannot be done with the theory based on continuous fluxes, since you would always conclude that you can land at any point you wish just by solving for the fluxes. Pretty interesting. So the rest of the talk, what I'm going to do is go through several examples very quickly, where we check the Kishore problems coming on questions 1 and 2, and begin to answer questions 3 and 4 by examining several of the whole state representative examples. And I won't have time to do every example in much detail, but I won't use several of the examples of studying, but I hope to give you a flavor of the kinds of results we go through. So my first example will be the simplest possibility. What could be simpler than a Calabi-Yau space? No model. So we'll take the Rizzi problem. And some facts about this were already discussed with David Gardner. So it's a Calabi-Yau with no deformation to its complex structure. And so the periods are pretty simple. There are only 2 3 cycles. If there's no H1, then H0 is 3 and 0. Okay, so there's 1 A cycle and 1 B cycle. And we'll just imagine it's so the periods are 1 and 5. Well, the resulting flux superpotential is only one field in the game in the delta. And it's easy to see that then it'll be uniform A5 plus B, where A is a complex number determined by the NS flux. So these are integers. And B is a complex number from the butt, but low flux. And the free ray charge in the pluses is given by H by F, which turns out to be this. Now, the equation for vacuuming this model is V by W equals 0, and it's the work of a moment to miss yourself from this expression. So that leads to A phi bar plus B is 0. So phi bar is minus B over F. And if you impose the phi by in the allowed region, that is its imaginary part of the positive, you'll see that that does indeed imply an influx of positive. So let's go through the questions. This is several possible examples of the control. We have to be careful to lot out by gauge symmetries, or we'll always want to do it factually. In this case, there's only one field, and there's one gauge symmetry, SL2Z. So we should gauge fix SL2Z. And we can gauge fix SL2Z in the following way. We can show that it allows one, in this example, to set F2-0 and down H1 within these values. In general models, you might have to worry about special points where you have to do additional gauge fixes. But in these models, we don't, because the special points don't. Well, then, N-flux being less than or equal to L just says the gauge fixing F2 is 0, so it doesn't have one of the H2 should be less than or equal to L. And then you can count the number of N-flux factors by just summing up for all M B from 1 to L, count the amount of charge and fluxes. The number of ways you can write M as a product of two integers. Now, this function is a famous function in number theory that they might not know, and the result is pi squared over 12 times L squared. And this, well, first of all, obviously, we call it B3, which in B3 is 3, and the coefficient is pi squared over 12, and that also has to be a okay, what's the distribution of that? That's the index, which is even more detailed than the number of cosines. Of course, in general, that's not an integer, so it's not really great. Now, the distribution of that is slightly more interesting to ask about. So let's now use a different gauge fixing that would be more convenient for us. Let's just require that the phi can be determined by in the fundamental domain. That will also fix SL2Z for us. Well, the number of complex numbers of the form n plus im, with n and m being integer, and with given norm, c, feels likely by c to c. And for large c, the phase complex number is then uniformly distributed on that circle of gradient succeeds. So we can estimate the number of pairs of complex fluxes A and B, which lead to a given value of dilaton with imaginary part y, that is with 1 over g squared equal y. And we find the fundamental domain in the following trivial way. Let's make some changes of variables. Let's say big A is of norm little a and has space beta. And the big B is from norm little b and has space beta whole psi. Okay, or it's q by beta times beta when beta is its norm psi. Well, then the constraints on these vacua translate into, well, the constraint on flux in less than or equal to L, and it's into L greater than in the sine psi. The solution for the dilaton tells you that its imaginary part y is b over a sine psi. And in particular, you can conclude from that that little a only runs up in the middle. So the distribution of vacua can then be easily estimated. The density of vacua in a given phi is obtained by integrating over all the a values and all the beta values that land you with that given value of phi. And that integral can be performed exactly. Okay, it's as easy as it looks. The only non-trivial step is getting the 1 over a squared by taking the 1 over a out of the delta function. And it scales by L squared over y squared. This is exactly 1 over n pi squared, the expected measure on the moduli space for something like a complex structure over n over a dilaton. Okay? And again, you can get the normalization right both spots. So the distribution there is easy to work out, and it agrees. Let's look at more detailed questions that I was going to ask. In this example, they're quite simple to answer. There are no vacuum limits. If you set a phi plus b, which is w is 0, you find phi is minus b over a, but phi bar is also minus b over a, the phi equals phi bar, the imaginary part vanishes, and you're in the boundary of the And finally, let's answer the question about skew symmetry, which again can be done completely in this model. There are two fixed points that are from modular group, I and e by pi over 3. So since y bar is a ratio of complex numbers of two pieces, the secondary point, which has a three in it, is inaccessible. Okay. That's the most trivial example of number theory after we play a role in question. That implies equal I, on the other hand, since that's what I said, you're multiple I. You can, in fact, find solutions. You need h1, mu minus f2, and h3 to f1. So, from the capital condition, you're discounting points for f1 squared plus f2 squared is less than l. And that's just a circle. So, the points inside the circle give you pi l back. And so, in this example, the fraction of enhanced symmetry is the number at pi. Sorry, if I equal I, why that total number is lower up. Okay, now that example, you might be suspicious, is too trivial to really illustrate many phenomena, so I'll do a few more that are increasingly complicated, but we'll find that that example is a reasonable guide for what kinds of things you should expect, namely small powers of 1 over L suppression for various phenomena, as opposed to, for instance, exponential suppression. Okay, a second example, slightly more non-trivial, but only slightly, is studying vacua on a product of 3 neutral I with common modulus. Now, a general 6 torus has 20 different free forms. Okay, so you take periodic versions xi and yi of period 1, and you can describe the free forms as the form dx, dx, dx. Dx, dx, that should be dy. Dy, dy, dx, and dy, dy, dy. And they satisfy this simple inner product of the numbers of y. And we'll just take simple CH for the more free form, dz1 with dz2 with dz3, where the z coordinates, the complex coordinates, are where the moduli of the torus are hidden. Dzi is defined to be dxi plus tau ij dyj. So tau is a period matrix, but for this example, tau will always mean the form tau of. Now, a most general flux on 6 torus, which you could ask about, would just be an expansion of f3 to h3 in terms of that basis of integral cohomology with integer coefficients a naught, aij, bij, b naught, and some other things. But we're only interested in the vacua that have one additional one that's tau. So you can show that there are shape fluxes where all these matrices with ij indices are just integers times delta ij. You always get a solution in this form, and that's the most general class of fluxes that we'll use in that form. So we'll look at the special class of fluxes specified by integers A, B, C, D, and the other index list of parameters. Now, for counting generic vacua, there are results from Dev and Douglas that show that the number is pi over 9 delta 4. And we all have word this as element 2D. For W equals 0 vacua, as I said, you can't have a result from the formulas, but you can develop some other technique. Okay, so for supersymmetric vacua, you have to have W equals D by W equals D by W equals 0. And you can show easily what that implies is that the modulus parameter tau of the force must satisfy the equations that f dot pi equals h dot pi equals 0 with pi to period 0. Now, for a torus, the period vector is tau cubed, tau squared, tau 1. So what this means is that two cubic equations, one determined by the f-flux and one by the h-flux, must be satisfied by tau, this method. Now, clearly, a general set of two cubics don't have a complex root of tau, but we need n tau non-zero. So we know that to solve these equations, p1 and p2 actually have to have a quadratic vector. See, they're cubics with real coefficients. They have a complex root. It's conjugate also root. So what we're interested in doing is basically computing the fraction of two cubics over the integers that have a factor. SL2C, again, acts in this problem. In fact, acts twice. There's one SL2Z acting on phi and fixing the pluses, and an SL2Z acting on tau, no real life. To fix the S duality, we can set C0 to 0, that is, make one of the cubics quadratic, and down one of the coefficients in terms of the other. And having made one of the cubics quadratic, the system of equations boils down to, well, the quadratic I has to be a multiple of some quadratic, which factors the other cubic. So P of tau is quadratic, and the two cubics are integral multiples. Now, I'll go to something really quickly here because this is just tedious to do the analysis this way. There's a better way in this one. But the system of equations is a little redundant the way I wrote it. There are common factors that can be factored out sometimes. 3C3D do not have an divisor, then you can shuffle into K, come back around the position. So you should choose K in some smart way to avoid that redundancy. There are also various non-free constraints on the integers. Okay. But the basic lesson is that you should sum over all relative weak prime L, M, N, determined by that, and sum over F, G, and K, consistent with the matrix, such that the capital condition is satisfied. And the capital in this model is the widest product of the integers. Now, the only thing you really need to take away from this is that the question was very, algebraic or numbers of radical nature. And the constraints above, along with the requirement that tau line is fundamental domain, you can show now actually yield a finite volume of flux space. So the two SL2Zs take what is a priori obviously the number of acolytes and truncate it to a finite term. And in fact, the finite volume of flux space scales by that square. But that's the area in this seven-dimensional space of integers. Scales like that. So our conclusion is that the number of acolytes in this model that satisfy W equals 0, would have to have W generated non-recurve if we were this more realistic model, over the total number of acolytes, scales like 1 over L squared. And here's some figures. Here's the count of the Suzy acolytes done both numerically and analytically. You see they do pretty well. Probably I came back to a significant amount of lines. This is a function of L, which is much better of our L. And there's a more interesting plot that hints at things that I want to discuss, okay, which shows where the vacuole lie, the supersymmetric vacuole. So here's the tau plane. This would be the semi-symmetrical bounded, except that you scale the axes in a funny way before on the picture, so it'll look like that's semi-symmetrical. And you see that there's a lot of structure in the plot. This is for L equals 2,000, which is a lot of large values. But smaller values to balance structure is even more pronounced. You see that the distribution is far from random, it has structure. You can understand this structure using something called deep engineering geometry, but I don't find that. Okay. So I've done two trivial examples looking at different features, the fractions of supersymmetric vacua, the fractions of discretely symmetric vacua, and we see that at least in simple examples, the lesson is that to ask for something non-generic like that costs the power of 1 over L, not a very high power, but some power. I'll move on to more non-trivial examples. We also are studying four one-parameter Kolodyi hypersurfaces. There are four of these made by equations of the right degree in projective pore space in various regions.
Is there symmetric fraction of symmetric fraction?
On the torus? There is. I'm not talking about it just because I already answered it. So there are, as we're studying, but I didn't think of that.
Some power?
Some power. Okay. The third example is all four one-parameter Kolodyi hypersurfaces in some locus that we study. We're also studying a two-parameter Kolodyi hypersurface, but I don't have time to talk about it. Okay. So these are the four. And when I call them one-parameter, what I really need, as people studying the subject know, is that they're mirror manifolds of one complex parameter. So you can either approach these by appropriate discrete groups to get one complex structure parameter manifolds, or you can just look at a symmetric locus where they emit the match of the so-called B plus group and restrict your attention to that locus. The number of axes in each example scales like L in the fourth for all four. We verify that numerically, the periods are all complicated, but if you do the iterating properly, the scaling is as expected. In all of these models, the modular space is known. There are only three interesting points, large complex structure, conical, and the Mann-Ebensburg point. And the so-called Mann-Ebensburg point should be thought of, people who don't know why I call it the Mann-Ebensburg point, as a point that has to be in symmetry. And the model labeled as MK here, K is the degree of the Kleinian equation, the Mann-Ebensburg point has to see K in symmetry. Now, an interesting fact about the Mann-Ebensburg point, which is where we'll do our analysis, since it's the one in the symmetry point, is that at this point, the periods are very strange. In fact, the periods and their derivatives take values in the cyclotomic field Fk. So the cyclotomic field Fk is the extension of the rationals by k through the union. And this is not just true for these 4-1 regular models. In fact, it's generally true for rhetoric Claudius and having a three-word point, that the theory is, at least in the car proof cases, have some simple structure like this. Now, the degree of the extension of k is given by the number of integers less than k that are relative to prime k, they otherwise are related. And that can be computed by something called the Euler-Tocher function. So the degree of the extension of the rationals for k is just given by this formula, which computes the Euler-Tocher function. P is the prime factors k, and then this is just the second. Now, the equations of motion are that d phi and d psi should vanish for psi is one complex structure in random. And that boils down to some simple set of equations that depend on the degree of. If you don't assume anything special about where you are, you don't find a space. You generically can't solve the equations. But if phi also lies in the second of the field, then, in fact, we can think of the problem as follows. Phi in solution, exactly at the symmetric point, at the lambda against free point, imposes two phi k equations on the integer fluxes. Okay, once we specify the points in moduli space, we use view the equations as equations on the integer fluxes. And there are two phi k equations because each equation has five k components, that's the degree of field extension. So since there exist eight integers, for a given one parameter model, a flux integer is because there are three cycles, so both n and r flux. Solutions will always exist if 2 times 5k is less than 8, because the number of equations will only be less than the number of specified pluses. But more generally, at such a point in the model of any D3, okay, where the periods have this weird property, if you define alpha to be 2D3s, which is the number of integer fluxes you have, minus the number of equations you have, which is d21 plus 1 times the solar function function, plus gamma, where gamma is some number of relations that lie between the equations. That sounds like a flight factor, but in fact, these models are very degenerate points in the model space, not in our relations in any period. So if you find alpha this way, the number of vacuum I've learned against Berkeley in all those tails, like L and the alpha. That's just root L to the power of the number of fluxes that you have unconstrained by the equations. Now, for symmetric solutions, at lambda over here, you get one additional equation in this tree. And so the number of solutions that are supersymmetric at lambda over here should be expected to scale as L to the alpha minus lambda over 2. Now, I should also note that although I said the lambda Ginsburg point has enhanced ZK symmetry, it is not true that a solution that lands you at that point in moduli space has an enhanced symmetry necessarily, because you could land in that moduli space governed by fluxes that spontaneously break the symmetry. So you actually have to check to make sure the fluxes that land you at the lambda Ginsburg point don't break the symmetry. That doesn't arise in the rigid example, but it does arise. And the results are the following. For M5 and M10, there are no vacuum at the lambda. For M6, there are some vacuum there, and the number scales like L squared, not L. For the number of supersymmetric vacuum of lambda given for the M6, 1 over L of the vacuum that are there at all have supersymmetry. And 1 over L of the vacuum that are there at all have the discrete symmetry. So again, you see these factors of 1 over L is small power. And for the degree 8 example, the number of vacuum there scales like 1 over L squared compared to the total number. That here, they're always happy against symmetry, and none of them are symmetry. Now, that's a laundry list. The main reason to do several examples isn't because each one is fascinating in and of itself, but because you want to know whether the lessons that you're learning have any generality, and I think we're closing in on a place where we can say some things. Okay. Let me say them in order of decreasing surety. No approximations to string theory, at least any approximation I know of, tells us that the theory has lots of vacuum. There is not techniques we presently have, or conceptual approximations we presently have, any a priori reason to pick one over the other. And so from the top-down perspective, one characteristic of the theory is the distributions of those vacuum, and we should study it. In one particular case, which contains a large class of vacuum, these 2D constructions, there is a statistical theory that describes the crudest features through a structure of us and other authors extending it, and it seems quite successful. And what's nice about that isn't just that there's a theory for some complicated thing that summarizes properties in one line, like I showed you, but that it actually leads one to notice interesting features. Let me tell you one example of such a feature that I've explained in other talks on the subject, and I'm going to explain here. Here's the distribution of vacua in all these one-parameter models. Near a special point in normalized space, called the conical, most people will notice that there's a feature in this graph. This feature is very interesting. It teaches us something about physics, but I won't talk about it. Okay. For special vacua that people might be specially interested in, for instance, vacua that are supersymmetric, or have W equals 0, even in arc symmetry, or have other kinds of discrete symmetries, there is a theory that is being developed as we're trying to figure out how to correctly attack those questions. And you can already say with some confidence, because I can make more of this more and justify it, that it seems like the cost for any of these things, in general, will be like 1 over L over M, where N is an order M number, sorry, order 1 number, in any Gaussian model. And that's certainly consistent with the results we've seen so far. There is a lot of math that one can use to try and attack this problem in various cases. There's something called the theory of heights in the advanced geometry that seems like it can play a useful role, and my collaborators are trying to force me more in writing. But the role that it plays is in itself. The most obvious questions for the future, well, to me, the most obvious question is to learn whether any such theory is broadly applicable in the future of something about theory, about string theory. How would you do that? Well, the study types you do that to whether a large number of them, but of course, every moment of theory manifests a similarly huge number of vacua in any approximation we now know about. So, types away on a lot of the models can be studied. Canonical strings can be studied. I think it's actually important that you study a batch of vacua that are generic enough to capture the essence of the problem. It turns out that for largely sociological reasons, the Hadronic string has not been studied in such a general setting. It just get complex superposition trio. In Hadronic string, you need to put it on and on Taylor, but supersymmetric preserving space. Those exist. They haven't been studied in much detail. People are now starting to study Hadronic strings on these spaces that have three structures of various sorts in the presence of flux. And that theory will eventually lead to some kind of distribution that can be attacked with some more techniques. And a lot of tools on Calabi asked, of course, you could do this already, but there's some technical reason why it's great. Now, if you did this, the most obvious thing to do would be to take the results from 2A and 2B and M theory and heterotic string, and then compare them. But the spaces are different, so what I mean by compare is you compare the claims about statistical frequencies in various 3D. It's like how often something zero arrives, how often does free generation arise. And you can see that the samples in each corner are actually large enough that, that they agree, that they're each sampling a large enough subset that, that they're getting at the universal features in this distribution of vacuum. There's a question we will never answer, very related to a question that I was asked earlier in this talk, which is, again, since the value of the inclusion of the M theory star, there's a region in this M theory star. And here, we're never going to be able to compute. It's quite plausible that the distributions in here might be different from the ones at the corners, even if we understood the corners and they all agree. This is always true in physics. I have nothing new to say about it. You can study the theories you can see and not the ones. This would be a hint, anyway, if you do these calculations and they all agree. That we're really looking to represent a sample of string vacua, and we have some characteristics of the theory in hand. Now, there's an elephant in the closet, which is that all the way through this talk, I've been talking about spaces that preserve supersymmetry and includes the Quine scale. String theory is, of course, only write papers about theories that are supersymmetric, but string theory itself doesn't necessarily have the same case. Okay? It could well be true that there are lots of vacua. Their supersymmetry is broken even at the k case scale, or maybe even finer scale. Evidence for such things arose in the work of Wilson Polchinski and more concretely along these Oberstein and Stroninger. I don't have anything to say about that, but it's a big elephant in the plot. You don't know if studying supersymmetric vacua is any part of what string theory really says. The statistics of string vacua may not match the statistics of string papers. Now, although I work on this subject, and I think it's clear that there are technical results that are non-vacuous, that are verified mathematically, it's hard to really hope that what we're going to do is completely characterize the space of solutions, suppose 20 cuts on it from the standard model, and find a unique vacuum. Maybe we'll do that, maybe we won't. So the last, but certainly not least hope, is that this subject can lead to or help inspire new ideas in string phenomenology that may characterize only corners of the space but may actually be observed and tell us where we are. And that's already happened. There's this subject called split supersymmetry that has grown out in the works of these guys. There has been work on new models of inflection not related to these subjects with a renewed hope that maybe cosmic superstrings will be visible. That models of inflation with measurable non-gas scanning may arise in theory in some modern generic circumstance, not just one particular sort of model, but any time you have relativistic grains. The models of inflation with no solar law may arise in natural circumstances in some of these very complicated models. And hopefully there are many more such ideas to come, because my own gut feeling is the way string theory will eventually make contact with the rest of physics will be through some such spectacular isolated phenomena and not for the top-down derivation of the structure of the world. So, thanks.
I want to get to your intuition about the question that I tried to why don't I hear people saying the following? The consistency conditions, especially in hierarchy, is to make the superstring theory work as subtle, are difficult to achieve as far as we know so far, fire, symmetry, etc. Maybe many of these vacuoles satisfy the low energy equations and just don't lead to consistent quantum superstring theories.
And you know, you can always say that. The reason string theorists, at least the ones that I talked to, don't, is that starting in the mid-90s, it became clear that with very crude knowledge based on space-time physics, you could make powerful deep observations about this phenomenon that were not made from a logic perspective, that seemed hopelessly difficult to study from a logic perspective, but turn out with amazing regularity to be true. Okay? Essentially, all the dualities were derived with no knowledge of logic. They rely crucially on things that are almost invisible in the world. ADS CFT studies back to over which there's essentially no hope about being able to
both as to how you make the CFT remains conjectures at the level of which comes.
I agree. And so all I'm saying is that the level at which string theorists work, subtle consistency conditions of higher genus have never played a role that contradicts something in that.
But that may just be because we don't get
maybe. Yeah, I'm not arguing with that. I'm just saying, here's a fact about how progress has been made if it's not really dead in that direction. And so if any time something that bothers you comes along, you decide to say, well, I don't want the theory to do this. Maybe there's going to be this aid condition that stops it. I worry that what you're doing is telling the theory what you want it to do, but not looking at what the theory is telling you. I could be wrong, but if you look at string theory papers over the last 15 years, without any top-down idea that somehow there's a direct vacuum that's chosen by the theory uniquely, you'll find, you know, the number of string authors has been, there are independent papers with different laws. And I don't see anything worth that.
Since the bottom line is that there's a large level of shift potential in fact from the site, more than large figures in the past. So we don't try to determine the position of the last of the specific quality. So then we're doing a really probability theory at classical level before we're doing a state of the record. Some of the strong deviation from the way we do physics for the last 50 years, certainly through classical and the limits. Sometimes I found
I didn't talk much about, I'll call it philosophy, but not in a majority sense, but because it's hard to imagine this being an experimental concept. But if you take all this very seriously, and I tend to actually take it very seriously, I actually think theory does not have a unique vacuum even after you say you want some system to work, since I see absolutely no evidence that it does. And if you take that seriously, you draw a picture of a theory with one field and this kind of potential with a few bumps in it. Okay. And if you think seriously about what this picture means, if string theory doesn't have a delta function resonance in one vacuum, suppose the universe, for some reason that we don't understand, started out with a little bit of the space theory. as soon as there are any positive potential vacuum, the space inflates, and it also tunnels. The inflation generally outraces the tunneling. That is, each point has an exponentially small probability of tunneling per unit volume per unit time, okay? But the inflation proceeds exponentially quickly. And so what will happen is that for a few reasons, if there are phases A, B, C, and so forth, the amount of volume in phase A without initial conditions will expand exponentially, but it would also populate phase B and phase C, and the amount of volume in phase B would expand exponentially in phase C. Now this kind of thing has come up in internal inflation. And if you take this picture only depends on effective field theory and well understood tunneling processes that happen, and the fact that the cosmological constant leads to accelerated expansion. Okay, and if this kind of picture is true, the implications for the larger scale structure of the universe are quite striking. It says that very far outside our horizon, there's a lot of stuff. There can be different gauges that's realized, and there can be all kinds of things. And if we could do the statistics of what our universe looks like on very large super horizon scales, I would be thrilled. I would see how this could be very analogous to regular system mechanics. But we can't. We're trapped in our own horizon. And so I think the implications are striking if this is true, but I don't know how to test it.
Do you feel there is an experiment that can be done to sitting in vacuum A? You can say something about vacuum B. Something like, you know, sitting holding as a vacuum is the distribution.
I mean, if you have a fairly high energies accessible, and if there's one small parameter in the problem, namely, it's the tension of the bubble that goes between phase A and B. And these models, we know this bubble. It's not just picture the bubble, the change of flux is perhaps deeper. Okay. And you can study the tension of these objects in some approximation. And if that tension were low enough, then yeah, of course, you can make a bubble. If you have a very high energy collider, or a high energy collider, but some very high energy producing machine, you can make a bubble of phase B. The ball would have some finite tension, but you know, you have to be energy where it doesn't form a black hole, or you can see that you've made a phase
bubble. But you want to keep everything in that,
another word where we'll observe a big problem. Yeah. So, I think the answer to this thought experiment is, yeah, there are probably parameter regimes for these differences in the heights where you can see other vacua, but it doesn't really sound very practical. It kind of has this flavor of the new Fermi stuff about the universes, black hole. Yeah.
So the guy you started in the second of the movie, right? You started off with you prefaced that last remark that if there's a big complicated potential and if they were evacuated or not, so there's never going to be more than one. I mean, to me, that sounds like that's the generic thing that you would be nuts not to expect. Is there an argument that would point towards there being one non-specific vacuum?
You won?
Well, you made it sound like there's a camp of string theory which doesn't believe that your picture is regular, that there's more than one non-specific vacuum. Is there a...
I think I just said indicates that there are zillions.
Yeah.
The only thing special about mine is that they had Susie broken below the KK scale.
But just starting from the point of view that there's just a lot of fields there and they're generically going to have a lot of minima, then you'd expect this is what's going to happen. So
I'll make a stronger statement. I mean, based on what I know, it's changed all the time. I bet this picture is basically wrong.
Well, yeah, so but I'm asking you why do we even talk about it? Why is it something you probably...
Yeah, the reason we have to talk about it is because there are many string theorists who really make this kind of picture.
But why? So what arguments do they have that...
I got yelled at a lot 10 years ago when I started studying this. And there is some deep-seated philosophical prejudice, which I have no access to because I don't have it, that having a unified theory implies it's a unique theory and implies this is unique that. And I have no idea why people feel strongly about that, but sure they do.
Yeah, the way
it does it is a lot of superspecific vacuum, which can't be unique vacuum. So there's a statement about uniqueness, it can't be that there's unique vacuum.
There exists a cult of people who we can call monovacuumists who believe that some deep condition. See, I think if you've been talking about uniqueness, it's a little tricky. I think the theory is unique. It's the question we're asking doesn't have a unique answer. Like in Newtonian gravity, theory is pretty unique, but the existence of the Earth is not. It's something contingent upon the general. But this cult of people would further say that not only is the theory unique, but it must make unique predictions for the questions that we happen to care about right now, like the existence of the age group with certain structure or the cosmological constant being at the value of the house. This part of the belief structure of string theory, although I was raised in the community, I do not understand, which has no evidence. But this belief structure does exist. It's a strongly held opinion in many people who I respect and appreciate. And I don't know what justification is for it.
So it's okay.
So. Yeah, but the string and line success physics a lot for the years, so based on normal vacuum calculation?
No, it's a calculation in a vacuum, it's not a model vacuum.
Yeah, it's a theory with the 20-something dimensional parameters.
Yeah, another way to say this is, no one says, in quantum field theory, the standard model theory, we measured it, and all other quantum field theory don't exist. Nor does anyone say the standard model is not a good theory because we have to do 19 experiments in addition to a large discrete number of checks to fix the gauge group structure in the parameters. So in this view of string theory, if you really hope that you can push this program theory in and understand the structure of the space of vacua and impose cuts on it, you could hope that after 25 cuts on the space of vacua, or maybe 5 cuts, you could predict a 6th thing. That you could say that 99% of vacua with properties A, B, and C will also have to. And you could go check that. And what I call that is normal science. That's how all science predicts. You impose a bunch of cuts on things to fix the theory, and then make one prediction. But that's not how most string theorists think. So although I agree, it doesn't make sense that this requires discussion. It seems to require a lot of discussion.
Yeah, I think the boundary has to be 300.
The cosmological constant alone might eliminate all that.
You said you were talking about saying that, what you see in the background, you're just going to be